person in general. But for this one, I rented a great big house about 3.5 hours north of LA in Paso Robles. There were 8 couples, and it was a really great trip. There was a no gifts rule, but I told everyone that I wanted them to either make something or perform something, and my friends rose to the occasion. If there is a theme to this book, maybe it's that if we ever meet, please come prepared with song and dance. It was a huge success and a total blast of a weekend, but I spent not one moment alone with Ben, and I noticed it. Even then I was thinking, this is odd. I'm staying up all night talking in bed with my girlfriends. Ben is downstairs playing ping pong, and I'm happy about that. Huh. On my actual birthday, I was hit with an odd wave of liberation. I'm not usually into those definitive age milestones, but I felt a weird sense of freedom that morning. And I think it was during that weekend that I subconsciously planted the seed that I was going to make a big transition with Ben soon. Not long after that getaway, I was filming a movie in England, and Ben and I decided to skip Christmas with our families and spend 2 weeks traveling the English countryside instead. It was an amazing trip, and we stayed at all these tiny inns and ate at funky cool pubs, and it was great. Except every day we were searching for conversation. I don't know if that had always been the case, and I had just never realized it, or if it was a new development, but I felt like I was working hard at communicating with him. I barely even knew what his interests were, which perhaps speaks to my own issues of being self-absorbed. I knew he was really good at interior design and fashion, both areas that are not my strong suit, to put it mildly. It was as if I suddenly realized, after almost a decade, that we had nothing in common. About 2 months after that trip, I left Ben. I have to be honest, it felt like a 200-pound backpack had been taken off my shoulders. I was so exhausted from trying to make the relationship work, which I think is another reason I stayed in it so long. The thought of breaking up felt even more draining than staying together. I would think to myself, if I kick him out of the apartment that we both signed the lease on, logistically, how does that work? What's the law about that? Fuck that. I was too tired. That relationship ended 10 years ago, and while I don't have any regrets, I certainly had some takeaways regarding how I wanted to approach my next relationship and how I might advise others wondering about marriage too. If I could instill one thing in my son, Jack, for example, it would be to wait until he is 30 to get married. I know that's a cynical thing to say, and I know it ruffles feathers, but for me, the 20s were so much about career growth. I was working really hard and was in a selfish place. I was a much more insecure and jealous person back then, and I didn't have a lot of extra room in my life to allow for a relationship, let alone a marriage. The best thing to come out of my first marriage for me was the recognition of what I want from the people in my life and what I need from those I surround myself with. People should constantly calibrate the amount of joy versus the amount of discontent a person brings them. I've eliminated as much as I can people who don't bring me happiness, and I've realized it's not worth it for any of us to keep those people in our lives. I basically take the same approach to my social life as Marie Kondo does to a coat closet. I have a good friend in a bad relationship, for example, and I try not to get too harpy with her, but I do challenge her with this basic idea of joy all the time. Think about this, I'll say. Does he make you happy 50% of the time? 60%? No one can expect to be completely happy 100% of the time, but if you're spending the majority of a relationship feeling like crap because of the other person, that probably means something. As I imagine is the case for any divorce, the failures of that relationship reverberated through my next one. My learnings from my marriage impacted who I chose to date next, and also the way I behaved with him. I'm happy to say that despite having just left a failed marriage, I was not skeptical of love or men or relationships the next time one came around. And as you'll soon see, that happened pretty fast. When I met Chris, the most striking thing about him was that he knew how to be happy and he knew how to make the best out of a bad day. He was constantly seeing the positive in everything. When I look back at my marriage and many of my relationships before it, I realized I had always equated cynicism, discontent, and anger with intelligence, and getting together with Chris made me re-examine that. It made me realize that being with someone who was well-liked and popular actually made me happy. Still, I didn't emerge from my first marriage completely unscathed. I'm only human, and I just ended a relationship that, all in, spanned 8 years of my life. So while I was struck by, even skeptical of, Chris's generosity of spirit, I definitely took an approach at the beginning of our relationship that could be categorized by a single mantra: I'm not putting up with any shit anymore. For example, when Chris and I started dating, he was chronically late. One time, he said he'd be over in 30 minutes, so I decided to cook. Chicken stuffed with lemons and roasted tomatoes in a big loaf of my famous garlic bread. Spoiler, it's famous because it's covered in butter. After an hour of waiting for him to show, I left. I walked out of my own home and went for a long walk. I didn't want to. In fact, I wanted desperately to see him, but I felt like I had spent so many years having so little power in my relationships, and I didn't want to be in a place in my life where I was constantly waiting for somebody. I had done that already, and was over it. I wanted some consideration. I had to set boundaries because I was so wary of feeling bulldozed in any way. When Chris finally showed up at my house, he called me in a panic, and I told him where I was, at a restaurant on Hollywood Boulevard by myself. After that, Chris was always on time, which I acknowledge is a good argument for relationship gameplay. I hate that term, but that's the reality of what I did. I liked Chris so much, but I didn't want to appear overeager. I would do things like not call him back immediately. I would wait a whole, 20 or 30 minutes because I was so proud, even though I wanted so much to hear his voice. I think the real problem was that as soon as Chris and I started dating, I wanted to marry him. I was head over heels, and that made me feel helpless in a period of my life when all I wanted was to feel powerful and understand my self-worth. I guess that was all part of the divorce journey, a phrase that genuinely makes me want to throw up. Listener advice: how to get over a breakup. There's a lot I don't know about navigating relationships. I know what has worked for me and what hasn't, but that's it. You're just as qualified as I am, dear listener, to give love advice, unless you're a psychologist or a psychiatrist or a social worker or, I don't know, a sex expert. Is that a thing? In which case, you are much more qualified than I am. I'm just lucky enough to have a platform to indulge my desire to tell people what to do in their relationships. But given the knowledge that I'm totally unqualified, I wanted to gather some of your thoughts too, so that any listener looking for actionable, helpful advice on dealing with a real problem might have a good range of tips to choose from. So I posted this question on Facebook: what's your best getting over a breakup advice? If someone called into your podcast with a broken heart, what would you tell them? Here's what you said. This is from Alec. Keep your mind busy. Dive into work, friendships, and hobbies. Don't stop to dwell on the past until you are far enough away from it to really understand what happened. And this is from Courtney. Let yourself have a weekend to indulge your feelings, because if you tuck them away, eventually they'll resurface. Then focus on all the other kinds of love in your life and keep busy by doing something on your bucket list or taking up a new hobby. Don't try to meet anyone right away, because we all need time to heal, and the next person you date deserves the best of you, not the parts of you that are still emotionally involved with your last partner. This is from Weston. Go out, even though it sucks mostly. Make as many friends as possible. Not Facebook friends, real friends. This is from Natasha. Allow yourself to be as sad as you need to be. The more you feel your feelings, the sooner you can move through them. Some people get over it in 3 days of sadness, and some take weeks. Stop pressuring yourself to be done at a certain time and treat yourself with compassion. This is from Katie. Drink the first night, because let's be real. Then pamper yourself and spend time with friends and family, and eat lots of pizza. This is from Anne. You need to go through the journey, the process of owning your responsibility in the relationship and the breakup. Be honest with yourself. At what point was there a first red flag that you ignored? And the next? And the next? When you examine that, you'll get insight. Is this a pattern? Why do I do that? What do I not value about myself that allows me to allow someone else to treat me badly? Once you do the difficult self-work, then you'll be free and ready to welcome the right partner in your life. It's neither fun nor easy to do that work, but it can be life-changing. This is from Allison. Delete them from all social media. You don't need to see any of that. Take some time away from social media too, because you'll be tempted to look and drive yourself crazy. This is from Cassian. I don't think you need to dwell on the past, but I don't think you need to forget it either. Time will do its work. There is no recipe for heartbreak, unfortunately. People who you loved will always be a part of you. You gave them your heart, so it's normal that they took a piece of it. For better or worse, they are part of your history. The only thing you can do is cherish what was good and forget about the bad, and focus on the future. Now you have a whole new opportunity to meet somebody else who will be even more awesome than your ex. This is from Dane. Get under as many people as possible. This is from Dory. I'm a firm believer in exes staying exes. If you broke up, it was for a reason, and chances are they didn't suddenly change overnight. Go out, have fun, and get outside your comfort zone. Don't worry about the timeline, worry about yourself. If you feel ready to start dating a week later, go for it. No one knows you better than you. This is from Samantha. Be really careful about the music that you listen to during the worst part of the breakup. I have ruined some of my favorite albums because I now associate most of the songs with feeling terrible. This is from Kelly. You don't just get over a bad breakup. You live it. You experience it. You wallow. You overanalyze. You question what went wrong and why you weren't good enough. It took me 3.5 years to get over the worst breakup of my life with the only person I've ever fully given my heart to. I experienced every feeling on every single level. Hatred, anger, sadness, confusion, guilt, etc. After you experience it, you wonder how to get over it for so long that you actually are over it before you even realize. You'll look back glad that it's over and glad that you've learned from it. There's no timetable that dictates how long it takes, but it will happen. This is from Rebecca. I like to do something I've never done, like go to the movies on my own or go on a hike. It gives a sense of independence that is refreshing. This is from Bethany. Take things one day at a time. Grieve because technically something did die, a relationship you had with a fellow human being. Do whatever you can to become a better person, whether it's pursuing deeper spirituality, taking up boxing, reading more, or meeting new people. And have at least one crazy night involving tequila. Take me home tonight. Literally. When I first met Chris, I was constantly looking for proof that he was not as great as he seemed. It was 2007, and we were in Phoenix filming Take Me Home Tonight, a movie about a bunch of recent college graduates in the late 80s that follows them over the course of one night. Chris and I played a couple. I was still married to Ben. It was after my 30th birthday weekend, but before our official breakup, and even though neither of us was happy in the relationship, I was still technically off the market. All the more reason why I was skeptical of Chris's general kindness. What was in it for him? One day I left my credit card at Kmart, and I mentioned that to Chris during shooting. He spent what felt like all day trying to track it down for me, talking to customer rep after customer rep and requesting to speak to the managers just to help me out. I was flabbergasted, and rather than accept that maybe this was just a good guy, I tried to analyze his motives. What did this cute but incredibly boyish big dude want from me? Why was he doing this? I had no clue. He can't fuck me, I thought. I'm married, so what is it? And then he kept doing nice things for me. They weren't creepy, they were just respectful. Because the movie largely takes place over one evening, the whole shoot, with the exception of one day, happened at night. After filming, Chris would walk me to my door or otherwise make sure I got home safely. It baffled me. We became friends over the course of filming, and I should be clear, he was having his own good time. He wasn't walking me home to get into my pants. He was hooking up with some of the cute background actresses, and I eventually started acting as his wingwoman. I loved it. and was so impressed with myself for being the cool girl who helped him hook up with hotties. But then I found myself feeling incredibly jealous of said hotties and started to wonder what the fuck was going on in my head. In hindsight, I was obviously crushing on him, but I don't know that I realized it at the time, even subconsciously. He was so different from anyone I'd ever been attracted to. He was kind and silly and totally beloved on set. Plus, as an actor, he was really good, and I was kind of taken aback by that. He was so daring and uninhibited during scenes, and I remember realizing that I was acting with someone who felt really free, and it was jarring and wonderful at the same time. Ben came to visit me one time during the filming of that movie. I ended up going home early, but everyone else, including Ben, went to a club, and he came crawling home from his wild night out at about 7 a.m. I don't know what exactly went down, but the next evening I was talking with Topher Grace, who played my brother in the film. "Anna, what the fuck are you doing with that guy?" he asked me. It was such a wonderful cold splash of water in the face. People had hedged around the idea that we weren't right for each other before, but that dancing around the issue approach made me defensive. Nobody had just come out and said it like that. I thought about the question for a moment, looked him in the eye, and answered. "I don't know," I said. The whole cast was staying in some dumpy apartment complex, and a few nights later, Chris invited a bunch of us to his apartment to hang out and eat elk rice-a-roni, made with elk that he had hunted, and brought with him from Salt Lake City. It was a fun evening, and Chris and I were at our peak banter. Though we didn't act on it physically, I couldn't deny that something was happening between us. The next day, I went to my friend Dan Fogler, a really talented actor and co-star of the film, and confided in him that I wanted to leave my husband and I didn't know what to do. "I saw you and Chris last night, and it was like I was watching ping pong," he said. He starred in Balls of Fury, a ping pong movie that came out that year, so it was top of mind. "You two were so into each other." Dan also told me that if I was going to leave my husband, I had to be a surgeon with a scalpel about it. "Do it immediately and effectively," he said. So I called Ben and told him over the phone that I was leaving him. And then went to set and was like, "Hey, everybody, I just left my husband." Pretty soon I was knocking on Chris's door and was basically like, "Hi, I'm ready to get boned." I know that leaving your husband over the phone is a questionable decision, and I definitely felt like the villain in that moment. But as I've mentioned before, a real part of the reason I didn't break up with Ben sooner was that the prospect of it just sounded so exhausting. Dealing with all the broken pieces of our relationship was daunting enough that I basically put it off until I couldn't anymore. And in an odd way, we'd been through so much together at that point that it felt like the only way to do it. Had I told him face to face, not only would I have had to wait longer, but it would have been horrible drama. Breaking the news from afar was, in some ways, the easy way out. I won't deny that. But even on the phone, I had to repeat myself a number of times before he took me at my word. "You're just tired. You're really tired," he responded at first. I just said, "Nope, I'm leaving you." And that was that. The end of the relationship was long overdue. We hadn't been happy for a while, but the reality is that if I hadn't met Chris, my first marriage probably would have lasted until I found a different someone else. Chris was my cattle prod. I needed someone to come along and show me something different than the relationship I knew, even if he did so without realizing it. I wish I could have figured that out on my own, but I didn't. It probably has to do with the public proclamation of marriage and my incredible reluctance to admit failure. Basically, my pride mixed with my what-did-I-do-wrong guilt was pretty hard to overcome. In the moment after I broke the news to the cast and crew, Chris and I exchanged a brief glance, and we both knew what it meant. When we finally got together, it was hot and heavy in a way that I'd never experienced before. I felt a little bit guilty, mostly because I didn't want him to feel like I was pressuring him to be in a relationship with me, like, "This is what you have to do because I left my husband." It was extremely important to me, especially toward the end of my relationship with Ben, not to sleep with anybody while we were together. I have complicated feelings about that now. Not that I think I should have cheated on him, but I realized that that moral stance was basically a way to let myself off the hook. I think about my motivation during that time period, and I think I was looking for something to hang my hat on. Sure, I get to proclaim I didn't fuck Chris before I left Ben, but what is there to celebrate in that? It didn't make me a hero. After all, I wanted to. Desperately. And I had feelings for him, obviously, even if I wasn't honest with myself about what those were. So while I didn't cheat, I'm not completely innocent, either. If someone called into the podcast asking if she should leave her husband for a hot actor she hadn't slept with but already had an emotional connection with, I would totally call her out, so I can't give myself a total pass. Damn podcast. Chris and I grew closer over the rest of the shoot. You might think that fresh off an almost decade-long relationship, I would be hesitant to move on to the next, but I couldn't have fallen more headfirst into my feelings for Chris. The relationship felt so different than my previous ones. It was laughter all the time. On one of our first dates, we were in a restaurant and Chris swatted at a fly. It was on the table and still kind of partially moving, so I grabbed it and popped it in my mouth and ate it. It was weird and gross and impulsive, but spoke to that part of me that indulgently wants to freak people out. I was taking a gamble that it would pay off and he'd be impressed, and it paid off. I think I was also trying to prove that I was a soldier and that I wasn't afraid of anything. I take pride in not being a high-maintenance person, which is probably exactly the kind of thing a high-maintenance person would say. From doing the podcast, I've come to learn that guys like to come to the rescue. On one of our episodes, I asked Sim if he was turned on by girls who know a lot about sports. Sim is a sports nut. He said no, and then went on to say that what actually turns him on is getting to educate women about sports, and of course, that makes sense. I was frustrated with myself for not coming to that conclusion on my own, because I think a lot of men really do like that, oh, I'm helpless, will you save me, personality trait. That's a quality I don't have. I'm too proud to play the damsel in distress. Instead, I eat a half-dead fly, and then I'm like, wanna make out? After filming was over, Chris and I got a rental car and drove back to LA from Phoenix together with all my shit. Upon returning, I had a lot to deal with in terms of ending my marriage. So I slept on a friend's couch, wore the same clothes every day, and got rides from Chris because Ben had our car. My life was pretty bizarre at the time, and in terms of my relationship with Chris, I was on high alert. There was all the baggage from my marriage, but I'd also seen Chris hook up with a handful of people on our set, and I knew some of the people he had dated in the past. The point is, I had my guard up. Still, we move fast. I think that's just the way I'm programmed. I like to know where things are going. I need the security and hate having questions unanswered. So when it comes to guys, I like assurance that they're in it. I like being certain of the goal. I guess that's why I didn't date much and was never very good at it. I'm too desperate for answers. That need for a clearly defined relationship is likely to blame for one of the more awkward interactions in my life, which came only a few months into dating Chris. Before we got together, he had planned a month-long backpacking trip through Europe with his friends and co-stars from the TV show Everwood. A month or so before he left, I was already irrationally resentful of the trip. I think it was partly because he had never called me his girlfriend before. I had no promise from him that things would pick up again when he got back. I knew Chris was crazy about me, and I was crazy about him, and he called me all the time, and we spent every night together, but we never officially used the boyfriend-girlfriend labels. When he left, I felt abandoned. I was lonely and pissed off he didn't call me his girlfriend, and I was starting to wonder if maybe he was just a player. Thus began that very brief period of time where I said, fuck it. I'm just going to screw my way through Hollywood. I didn't, though. I went to some parties and awkwardly asked guys out, but I didn't have the language to actually be romantically savvy. I would say, do you want to go out with me? And when the guy said, what? I'd say, what about your friend? So one night, while Chris was away and I hadn't talked to him in a couple of days, I went to a party and met a cute lawyer who worked in the district attorney's office. We seemed to hit it off, and a few days later, I invited him to meet me for a drink. I had never successfully asked anyone out before, but I figured that Chris was in Europe, probably hooking up with other people, so I should be doing the same, if only in LA. Of course, I didn't actually want to, deep down. It wasn't like this lawyer and I had an especially magical moment. I was just trying to build a wall to protect myself against the hurt that I saw coming. When the lawyer showed up for our date, I didn't even recognize him. We'd met on a really dark rooftop, and this was a really light restaurant, and I think I was more focused on myself than I was on him during that first meeting. But we had a drink, and he drove me home, and I invited him in for a nightcap. The whole time I was thinking about Chris, but the lawyer came in, and I went in for the kill. "So do you want to have sex with me?" I asked, not seductively at all. To his credit, the lawyer said, "You know, I think we've had too much to drink. Can I call you tomorrow?" "Ugh, fine," I said, pissed off that this guy wasn't jumping at the opportunity to take advantage of me. The next day, Chris called me from a train to Prague. I could tell there were girls in the background, and I was boiling with anger at the idea that he would talk to me while he was having fun with some probably impossibly sophisticated European ladies. Or maybe they were just some cool hippie Americans who actually enjoy backpacking through Europe. Either way, I wasn't having it. But then, seemingly out of nowhere, he said, "I just love you so much. I just want to marry you." Needless to say, I never talked to the lawyer again. I like to think that subconsciously I was interested in that specific guy because in my heart of hearts, I knew that he wouldn't really have sex with me even when I offered. I could have picked an easier target if I really wanted to get laid, but I think there was a subconscious reason that I chose to flirt with someone who was so incredibly practical, or as I called, ethical. When Chris got home, I finally broached the issue of our labels. "Are we doing this?" I asked. "Can I introduce you as my boyfriend?" He looked at me like I had three heads. "Yeah, of course," he said, and I was hit with a wave of guilt. I thought Chris wasn't calling me his girlfriend intentionally, that he was being noncommittal. But it was more that we weren't being social. We never did anything where the opportunity to call me his girlfriend presented itself. We were just having sex and making each other food all the time. Chris and I moved in together after 9 months of dating. I guess I really liked to jump in there, but living with Chris was an entirely different experience. He was so low maintenance. After my divorce, I couldn't sell my house, so I had to essentially rebuy it from Ben. I was pretty broke, but I was excited to move back in, and Chris's lease was up, so I suggested we live together. "Does it bother you at all that I lived here with my ex?" I asked him once. "No, not really," he said. And even though I think it actually did, his was a really generous answer. Still, it was a relief to both of us when we bought our new place a couple of years later. There was a feeling of joint ownership, like we were starting a new phase as a team. It was kind of Chris to not make me feel guilty that we lived in my old house. It was similar to when I asked him if he was bothered by the fact that I was married before, and he said, unsurprisingly, the perfect thing. "Baby, you were just chilling on ice." Turning the tables, deal breakers. When we do the deal breakers segment on the podcast, I'm always surprised by the things that some people say that they put up with in a romantic partner. And on the flip side, the things that some people just won't tolerate. Cassie Daniels, a segment producer for Unqualified, presented me with some deal breakers. It's a good and bizarre exercise in introspection. If a guy shaves his legs, is that a deal breaker? And I say, why does he shave his legs? And Cassie says, purely aesthetic. He doesn't like the look of hair. Does he not like the hair on me as well? Well, he hopes you shave too. I'm going to say deal breaker. I worry this leads into other high maintenance issues. I love weirdness in a guy, but this could be a gateway behavior. And is there a lot of hair that gets stuck in the drain? And what if he uses my razor? That would be annoying. I'd wonder why he doesn't do laser. I think The shaving would probably be about some insecurities that are bigger than just leg hair, so I'd try to say, it's okay, you can embrace the hair. But I don't have the energy to build anyone's confidence right now. So Cassie says, you're dating a guy and you're on one of your first dates. You go back to his place after a lovely evening and he shows you his desk with electrical parts on it and tells you he is building a time machine. Then he looks deep into your eyes and asks you if you'll come with him when he's ready. Deal breaker? And I say, not a deal breaker. This is a really interesting person. It might not be the person I marry, but I think I would have a lot of follow-up questions. The most obvious one would be, where would you go first? Cassie says, he'd go to 1973. Why? He just thinks it was a really interesting time. People were so much more open. He loved the energy. Does he like Back to the Future? Loves it. Huge fan. It's his favorite movie. On the page, he sounds like an interesting person, but now I'm worried that the conversation is going to go a little stale. I guess I would ask him, do you really believe in this? That we are truly traveling back in time? Well, there are a lot of doubters, he'd say, but you can't let doubters stop you from achieving your dreams. But we don't have to stay there for longer than a year. Oh, we're going long term? Yeah, it's a while. Can we go to the future? Because as a woman, there aren't a lot of times I want to go back to. He doesn't have that technology. How much time does he spend on his time machine? All the time he's not with you. I take it back, deal breaker. That's too much time spent on the time machine. Could you be friends? Sure. He'd be my curious friend who is into the 1970s. I would take a day trip up the coast to Hearst Castle with him. But nothing romantic? I don't know. I would be interested to see what he's like as a lover, maybe. If we were friends and there was a little hookup, I'd be interested to see what a time-traveling man was up to in bed. And I like that he picked 1973. Maybe he's a generous lover. So we'd take an overnighter and stay at a roadside inn and talk about his vast knowledge of history. You know what? Okay, I take it back. I'm a curious person, not a deal breaker. Cassie says, you're having sex with a guy, let's call him Alex, and during the deed, he calls you by his sister's name. Deal breaker? And I ask, what's his sister's name? Julie? Oh boy, this is a tough one. I don't think I would immediately stop because I'm not good with surprises like that. I think in my head I'd be thinking, did I hear that correctly? As opposed to stopping and asking, did you just call me by your sister's name? I hate to say this. I wish that I could feel comfortable enough to ask him about it afterward, but I feel like I might ask my friends what to do. Do I really like this guy? Yeah, you like him a lot, but it's still new. Then maybe I would have to ask him afterward, and I would be super tentative about it, because if I really liked him, I would want to believe that I heard him wrong, even if it were super audible. As we're cleaning up in the post-coital, I'd say, hey, I feel like you said Julie when we were having sex. Did I hear you correctly? He's going to tell you, you did. I was really embarrassed and wasn't sure if you heard it. I was talking to my sister earlier and we've been arguing a lot, so she's been on my mind. Has that ever happened before? No, never. It was a little jarring for me. I've never called out my brother's name after sex. I don't want to have sex with her. She's just in my head right now. Yeah, it's weird how during sex the rational parts of your brain shut off, but it threw me a little bit. I'm only attracted to you, not my sister. That's probably good. Thank you. Are we good? Yeah, you know, truthfully, I'm working really hard at being straightforward with people, so I'll just say that I kind of need to digest this for a minute. I feel like you're being really judgmental. I don't mean to be. This is just new for me. If you want, I could call my sister and she could explain that there's nothing sexual between us. No, I believe you. I don't need to call Julie. I just need a minute. Let's take a minute and chat in a bit. And then I would leave and call you, Cassie. If he has a lot of other great qualities, I think I would give it a one-time pass. It would be weird, and I'd never forget it. But if it happened a second time, I would definitely be like, I'm confused and can't get over it. My personal rule is no names during sex. It's such a deliberate thing to use a name. Like, okay, I'm going to call him Alex now. I'm trying to shut down that part of my brain during sex. What about if he cried after sex? I would find it fascinating, but I don't think I would judge him on it. I would tell my friends about Julie, but I wouldn't about the crying. That feels cruel. What about if he cried every time? Then I would tell a trusted friend and ask if they could guide me on it. Maybe it's just part of his release. Who knows? Maybe he would make me cry more. That's one of my goals this year. People talk about what a good release crying is, and it's really hard for me to let myself go to that place. Cassie says, you are dating a guy who is over 30 and you find out he's never been in a long-term relationship. Deal breaker? And I say, well, I'm going to ask him why. If we're at that place where we're talking about previous relationships, I'd probably say, do you mind my asking why? Is it because you don't want one? Have you moved a lot? Cassie says, no, I really want one. Do you date all similar types of people? No, I've dated all types of people. I can just tell quickly if we don't click. Really? How can you tell? It's an energy thing. Sometimes you just don't click. Like, you don't have the same movie interests. This is a deal breaker. He seems way too critical. This is why I wonder a lot about online dating, where you do things like profile matches. Because on the page, Chris and I are extremely different. He likes to watch sports and hunt, and my hobbies are hiking and reading. He likes country music. I like indie. But those are such superficial things and don't represent the bigger picture. It seems like this guy is looking for excuses to say the relationship won't work. I remember talking to a woman in LA who was single and attractive and in her late 30s, and she said that a guy on a date ate off her plate, and she was like, I could never. I felt like that was a really high bar. Even if something like that irks you, it shouldn't be your takeaway. After talking to this guy, I'd feel like I was under a microscope. What if I did something wrong? Like my tube socks, I wear tube socks. Maybe those are a big no-no for him. And during sex, I would be especially nervous. It would make my head spin a little bit. Cassie says, the guy you're dating tells you that when he gets married, he wants to take his wife's last name. Deal breaker? And I ask, does he hate his name? No, he just likes the idea of honoring his wife's roots. It's really important to him. That's cool. It feels a little grandiose, though. Like, thank you? Seems a bit like him volunteering to get my name tattooed on his arm. I don't need that. It's not a deal breaker, but it's mildly amusing, I guess. I wonder what else would sprout out of this. Where would this desire manifest itself in other parts of his life? It would be a deal breaker at this point in my life if a guy insisted I take his name. But I think the problem with this guy is that he might be too serious for me. It seems like he is trying to prove something, like, look how progressive I am. I don't have the energy for that. I might have in college, but not now. It also might indicate that he doesn't have the best sense of humor. I need a guy I can laugh with. Cassie says, during your first time having sex, the guy you just started dating turns on the TV and tells you he can only climax while watching The Golden Girls. In particular, scenes with Bea Arthur. Deal breaker? I ask, is it on his DVR? Cassie says, he has Hulu all queued up. I love The Golden Girls, but this is a deal breaker. I would hope that I knew an ex of his so I could mine her for information, but yeah, that seems like a forever hurdle. And also, not to be gossipy, but if I continued that relationship, I couldn't tell that story to my friends, and I would really want to tell that story to my friends. If he was a fantastic guy and I really loved everything else about him, maybe I would dig around eBay for something autographed by Bea Arthur to give him as a gift when we broke up. Just friends. A conversation between a man and a woman who've been pals for 15 years and haven't slept together. My podcast partner, Sim Sarna, is more than just a producer and the willing recipient of a constant barrage of fuck you, Sim. He's also a longtime friend. We go back over a decade, and it's always been platonic. Here's our take on how that's possible. So I say, Any conversation about our friendship has to start by addressing your bowel problems on our first couple's vacation. And Sim says, yes, that's true. And your advice to me was, next time you go on any vacation with a group of people, eat a bunch of Pepto or Imodium before you go. You said, stock up on those and you'll be fine. Your body will be backed up and feel awful for a week, but you won't have the runs. I say, that's how you know you've reached the pinnacle of friendship, when you can have that conversation. But for us, and correct me if I'm wrong, but for us to get to that point took time. We've known each other for years, so now the flaws we see in each other, shit-related or otherwise, have just become part of the package. Sim says, well, here's the thing, Anna. You and I are very similar people, so we can handle the flaws we see in each other because they are the same ones we see in ourselves. And I say, yes, that's true. Is that why we hit it off so quickly? Maybe this is where we get into slightly dangerous territory, and I don't know if you remember it the same way I do, but even though I was in a relationship when we met, I remember being completely drawn to you. Not necessarily in a super sexual way, but I remember thinking, oh, he's handsome, he's interesting. I think over time we really have developed a rare thing in that we are both straight and have a really healthy friendship that hasn't revolved around anything sexual. And for that to stay intact for more than 15 years, that's a really long time anywhere, but especially in Hollywood. Sim says, completely rare. It doesn't happen. When I first met you, I remember thinking, oh my God, she's so sweet and funny and very attractive, obviously, but you were dating Ben at the time. I was drawn to you, though, because no one had ever made me laugh that hard. You were so funny. And I say, really? Go on. And Sim says, not only were you funny, but you were self-deprecating and you were you. Everyone wanted to be around you, and I did too. I thought you were incredible. And I say, it's so true, I am. But seriously, I found your intelligence and your wit so refreshing. I instantly liked you better than all the other new people I was meeting. At the time, I was new to LA, and you were one of my very first friends. I was still compiling a social network, and I think we had a little bit of a kismet thing that I couldn't quite put my finger on. Sim says, do you remember the first time we met? It was at Le Colonial, at the corner of Beverly and Robertson. I remember because there was a lounge above the restaurant, and it was the hot spot for like 2 or 3 weeks. In LA, there was always the hot new place, and this was it for a brief moment in January 2001. And I say, I totally remember. You knew one of the producers of Scary Movie, and he invited me to go out with a bunch of his friends, and we all started hanging out as a group for a while, but I'm not friends with any of the others anymore, not because anything bad happened, just time. Yeah, but those were our friends for a long while. Today I'm Facebook friends with all of them, but it's been years since I've actually spoken to any of them. And I say, oh, I need to grill you on some of this because I have no idea where they've been. I'm not so active on Facebook. Sim says, that's interesting. I hadn't thought until now that you have zero connection to them since you're barely on Facebook. For me, if they had a picture of mine on social media, I think, wow, after 15 years, they are still in my life. But that's all it is, just a like on Facebook. Meanwhile, you probably haven't thought of them in years. Like if you saw our old friend Eddie, you'd be like, holy shit, I used to hang out with you every day and now I haven't seen you in 10 years. And I say, yeah, probably. Or I'd be like, sorry, what's your name again? No, I'm kidding. I don't mean to sound like such a bitch, but there are a lot of transitional people in Hollywood. Sim says, that's true. And I say, which is why it's so cool and unusual that we're still friends. Navigating heterosexual friendship is tricky, and that was especially true when we were in our 20s and all of us were putting on a bit of an act. Yet you always had something more to offer. I think we understood each other's sense of humor. And this might sound selfish, but you had more to offer me, personality-wise, than a lot of the other new people I was meeting. And Sim says, that's so nice of you to say. And I say, but really, as I think more about it, maybe the reason our friendship has worked is as simple as the fact that, Sim, you're not a fucking creep. Sim says, yep, that's pretty much what it comes down to. But I'll admit, I had a really rough time, especially at the beginning of our friendship, because you were in a relationship and the three of us became close, and I felt third-wheely a lot. It was strange to have a relationship with two people who I figured would be together for life, yet I clearly wanted to spend my time with one over the other. And I say, me? Sim says, absolutely not. And I say, I figured, but it's true. We've seen each other through so many relationships. Well, I've seen you through more than you have me, but not many. You're a monogamist like I am. Sim says, true. I haven't had that many girlfriends. And I say, I'm so grateful that Chris doesn't have that many female friends. I have some girlfriends and long-term relationships where their male partners have a lot of female friends, and I don't know, it's tough. Is it a completely archaic idea that men can't have female friends? I mean, you have me. Sim says, yeah, I hear what you're saying. I'm pretty sure that every one of my fiancé Amy's guy friends wants to sleep with her, so I understand feeling hesitant about your partner's relationships. And I say, totally. Sim says, but seriously, every single one, even the ones who are married with kids. And I say, is that because men are selfish in friendship? Do they think they're not getting anything out of a relationship with a woman if they can't entertain the idea of scoring or what? What is it, Sim? Why don't most men like being friends with women? Speak for all mankind, please. Sim says, I don't know. I'm a guy and I'm friends with you. But even in our case, we've had a platonic friendship for so long, and it has been hard for some people. My ex-wife had an issue with it. And I say, she did not care for me at all. Sim says, she didn't. She seemed threatened by our relationship, which is why you and I were out of touch for years. I was so glad you were at my wedding, but then we only saw each other a couple of times over the next 2 years while my marriage was crumbling. And I say, I wasn't mad at you for that because I understood, but I hated that when I did see you, you didn't seem very happy. Of course, I wasn't totally innocent in that. I think that at least on a subconscious level, I kind of knew that she wasn't digging me, so maybe I put a bit more attention into killing her with kindness. But I never wanted to stress her out or put her down. I always wanted to treat her well. Sim says, you tried. I was so disappointed that she was threatened by you because you really did try. And I say, she probably thought the same way I do in a lot of ways, that if a guy is going to be friends with a gal, usually he's at least partially thinking about getting laid. And Sim says, yeah, sure, for some guys that's the case, but I've never really been like that. I've always been comfortable with women as friends. I was such a late bloomer that when I would talk to girls or become friends with them, even in college, I just knew I had no chance with them. And I say, oh, Sim. Sim says, no, it's true, and it's fine, and it made it so that girls could get to know me and see me as a friend. I was always the friend guy, and I didn't mind it so much. In my 20s, I began to gain a little more confidence with women, but at the heart of it, I'm still a really shy guy who doesn't think he has a chance with most girls, so he's lucky to be friends with them. Then I say, you just tapped into something that I think is crucially important, which is that we were both late bloomers, and because of that, we approached every interaction with a this person does not want to fuck me attitude. In an odd way, that is a very fundamental common bond that contributes to everything we do. Maybe that's how we were able to maintain this friendship for so long, because neither of us would ever think someone wanted to screw us. There, we figured out the secret to men and women being friends. Be people who were awkward in childhood. Sim says, totally. When people ask me if men and women can be friends, I say yes. But I have to caveat that with the fact that, again, it's rare. Not necessarily winning the lottery rare, but winning the raffle at a carnival rare. Your odds are low, but there's a chance. And I say, but then what happens when one of you enters a relationship? Sim says, the same thing we did with Amy. When she and I started dating, she had to contend with the fact that there was another woman who consumed my life. Someone who, because she's my business partner, I think about every hour of the workday and I'm hearing her voice in my ear literally all the time. And I say, and she's an obnoxious actress. Sim says, and she's an obnoxious actress. Amy entered our relationship already feeling like the other woman, so it was difficult at the beginning, but I was totally upfront with her about my relationship with you, which is now both a personal friendship and a professional partnership, and she's been just amazing. And certainly it's a credit to you that you've gone out of your way to make her feel comfortable. And I say, that's kind of you to credit me, but she's been great. She's more confident than any woman I've seen you with, so when I reach out to her independently of you, she's completely engaged. She and I have a nice friendship, and it was important to me that she felt safe with the time that you and I spend together, There's nothing weird going on. We're just trying to make this silly podcast and we'll see what happens. But really, to her credit, she heard that. She registered what I had to say. If I were in Amy's shoes, I don't know if I could have dealt with this very well or at all. I would have been like, fuck this. Sim says, she was very mature about the whole thing, and I think that's part of it. Every day that I spend working on the podcast is partly because I want to create a life with her, and she's so proud of me and of us that it makes me continue to work harder. And I say, that is really sweet. Obviously, it's different with Chris and me because we've known each other for a decade, but you were in my life when he and I met. Sim said, I met him before you did. And I say, oh yeah, I forgot about that. Why do I forget anything that's not about me? And Sim says, we weren't friends or anything, but I had met him socially before. And I say, I will say that after we started the podcast, Chris said to me, so is Sim like your best friend now? It wasn't an accusation. There was no undertone of, are you sleeping with him, or any kind of allusion to anything sexual, but it was a vulnerable moment on his part because you and I were spending so much time together. It was sweet, though. I loved that he was missing my company. On one hand, Chris is incredibly impressed by the fact that you and I just talked about creating this thing a couple of years ago, and now it is actually happening. On the other hand, this is more time away from family life, and that will be the constant struggle of all our lives. But it was of comfort to me that he said that. I would have been really bummed if he was like, no, talk to Sim as long as you want. Do whatever you want. I'm fine. It's always nice when someone wants to be around you. And Sim says, everyone wants to be around you. Why do you think so many people agreed to do our podcast back when it was new and unknown? People love to hang out with you. And I say, fuck you, Sim. Scoliosis check. Each year of middle school, there was one day where we had no choice but to reveal our bodies to the other girls in the grade. That day was scoliosis check day. I was incredibly flat-chested in middle school. I got a training bra long before I needed it, just because everyone else had one, and I got made fun of, a lot, for my lack of boobs. Most days, even in the locker room before gym, you didn't have to take your shirt off in front of anyone. You could just do that maneuver where you put one shirt on before taking the other one off and poof, you were in your gym clothes. But for scoliosis check, you had to line up in your bra and wait to bend over so the nurse could check your spine. It was the longest wait ever. I couldn't have been flatter, and I was sure the other girls were all quietly assessing my completely lacking body. Scoliosis check day was not a fun day. To the extent that I developed at all, I never grew to be very tall, and I certainly didn't wake up as a C-cup one day. It happened relatively late. In high school, I could have easily been cast as one of the geeks and freaks and geeks. I had no boobs, no curves, and I wanted those things desperately. My classmates used to talk about being on the rag or getting a visit from Aunt Flo, and I had no idea what they were talking about. I seriously believed, okay, I guess this isn't going to happen for me. I'm going to be one of those girls whose period just doesn't come. I finally got it when I was 15. During my junior year of high school, I went through a small growth spurt and put on a little bit of weight, enough to distinguish myself from a fifth grade boy, at least. And by senior year, there were a couple of times when I actually started to feel more attractive. One day, this guy Shane looked up at me and said, man, you've really grown up, Ferris. And despite the fact that I probably should have been disgusted, instead I was like, no way. Could I be attractive? That was a really exciting idea for me, even though I didn't really buy into it. Hot girl has never been an identity that I've been fully comfortable with. Even if I'm in hot pants and my hair and makeup are done and I'm playing a character who feels hot, I just can't embrace it. And that's not because I think I'm unattractive or anything. I just think you have to take yourself really seriously to identify as hot. And to this day, I have too much wrapped up in the idea of being the incredibly insecure 15-year-old who nobody wants to hook up with. I think that identity will forever be a part of me, and I don't really mind. Like all women, I also remember the day I realized that my weight would always be a point of discussion. When I was 13, I was at a coffee shop with my friend and her mom, and I ordered a hot chocolate with whipped cream. Are you sure you want whipped cream with that? My friend's mom asked me. That was a mile marker for me. It was the first time I thought, oh, fuck, am I not supposed to get the whipped cream? As for the mom, like most adults who have no idea how impactful their supposedly innocuous comments are, she probably thought nothing of it. She was desensitized. It really threw me, and I felt so ashamed. I didn't finish my hot chocolate or eat the whipped cream in the end because I immediately thought I must be fat or I was going to get fat. Overall, though, my body image stuff has been much more about my face and breasts than my body size. I never had a crazy obsession with weight. It's probably only third or fourth on my list of body image issues. First comes face, particularly lips, then breasts, then weight, then hands. And yes, it's sad that I can cite a list and that I can guarantee that all women have these lists. I was about to write that I can't imagine a man having a similar list, but I don't know. Living in Hollywood, I've definitely been around some vain men, a number of whom have been unattractively obsessed with how they look or what they weigh or how much hair they've lost, which is actually really comforting to us women at the end of the day. At least dudes have their own stuff they beat themselves up about. Self-obsession is more commonplace in today's world of selfies, too. It's more socially acceptable to be at once insecure and vain about looks, no matter